Blog Talk Radio. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's Friday night, and welcome to another episode of Continuation with James McCormick. I'm your co-host, Rich Kilblaine, and as usual, we have Father Michael Pacello on the show. And tonight's show, we're going to take a little bit of a break from current events. I don't know if we will stay away from it too long, because tonight's topic has some relevance to that subject. And so what we're going to talk about tonight is accepting personal responsibility versus collective culpability. Okay? So with that, Father Michael, how have you been doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. A dear friend of mine is in the hospital with COVID, so there's always that concern for our friends and loved ones, but we're getting ready to move, and so a lot of things are happening, but I'm excited about the topic tonight. Look forward to talking with you and with James.
Yeah. Well, hey, school has already started. How many college classes are you teaching this semester?
Four. I have a seminary class, which is a graduate class, where I have students from all over the country, and have three live philosophy classes at Christopher Newport University. And, of course, I'm involved with the ROTC as well. I'm really excited. I love teaching philosophy. We've been talking about truth and misrepresentation and falsity, embellishments, exaggeration, short of lying, humbug, BS, and I'm trying to prepare them so that they can wade through all of that as they prepare their argument papers for me. I read my own title of my book, From Valor to Virtue, The Moral Development of the Brave, and I read them my proposal or my thesis statement to just help them to try to deal with truth and not overtone. So I'm real excited about what I'm going to share with them, and I have some good class. I probably have about close to 70 students this semester.
Wow, look, that's a whole lot better than I'm doing, because I'm still getting in fights with girls and losing, okay? Yeah, now my focus is being Aikido, and I've got one of my senior students is deciding to take the traditional route and test for black belts. So I'm working, I'm affiliated with two different larger umbrella schools, Midwest Aikido Federation and the USAF, United States Aikido Federation, or YMATA. And so we're looking like at the best route for him to test. And then, of course, there's that debate on YouTube as to whether Aikido is an effective martial art or not, any other martial art. And since I come from a competitive background in other martial arts, I felt qualified to do that, and my strongest skill set was boxing. So I filmed all our sparring, and I share it with, because we can study it. I can see, like Amanda, she'll do something, and it's just instinctive, and I look at it like, wait a minute, I think you can turn that into a technique, and so we will work with it, and there it is. What's funny, though, is the first video we produced, which is Aikido, if you just go on YouTube and type in Aikido v. Boxing, it will pop up in like the top three, if it's not the top one. And it's me doing Aikido against a man. And what's interesting is most of the comments underneath it were, again, they're still skeptics. And as I warned Amanda, I said, because the comments under most of the other videos where people have tried to show how Aikido works. And what's interesting is Now you can't read them because a lot of them have been just so negative. People have just, you know, cut the comments off and they're unlisted. And I knew that the criticism was going to be against the boxer. If the boxer isn't convincing, the Aikido is not convincing. And it's funny because she's fast, real fast. But she doesn't, you know, she, at the time we had produced that sparring video, she had probably only been, you know, learning, practicing boxing for a year. All right. But it's interesting is the debate kind of ends when they say, well, she can't punch. I said, but she's fast, and that's it. But a more productive comment, which is like, you know, we would kind of like to see you try that Aikido against somebody of your own boxing skill level. Because I ended the video with my bag workout, to show one, I am a boxer, or was a boxer, and I know what I'm talking about. But it's interesting because when I there's a number of Aikido instructors and a female boxer, Belinda, who I share these videos, our sparring videos with, to get their comments. They'll see things I don't see. And what's interesting is after a while, they quit commenting about me, and they're all talking about Amanda. And it turns out that she doesn't have the muscles, so she or the boxing skills I do, so she can't fight the way I do. And she basically had to do a lot of body movement. In other words, she's doing more Aikido. Her Aikido turned out to be better than mine in sparring. And I got 50 pounds on her. I got a 3-inch reach on her. And so, you know, everybody's more impressed at how easily she was throwing me around. And I realized, you know what? I got this all wrong. We need to reverse roles. I think what people want to see is me the boxer and her the Aikidoist. And so we just finished filming. We did 3 days, 3 rounds each day, and I picked the 3 best rounds, and we'll put those, you know, we'll put those together. We got really good Aikido. And then it's going to be hard to say, hey, that won't work against a boxer when, well, yeah, I was a boxer back as a light middleweight champion at West Point.
Let me mention to you, I had the great privilege of sparring the grandmaster of Tang Sudo, Mudaquan, and I was honored that he even allowed me, and I'm sure he could have handed me my head. But during the bout, I scored on him. And after it was over, he said to me, you have boxing skills. You have a boxing background? Now, I had an uncle that when he was in college, they had a professional boxer come and visit. I believe it was in Tennessee. And my uncle beat him. My uncle later became middleweight, Jumping Joe Mitchell. And Jack Dempsey, my uncle was quite old. He's been dead quite a long time ago. My parents would be 103. And so Jack Dempsey was actually a ref in one of his fights. And so I believe, Rich, that, yes, it might be able to oppose a boxer, but I think a boxer has a lot of wonderful skills that they can use against a martial artist, in my limited experience in comparison to you.
Yeah, that has been brought up. But, you know, like one kid, yeah, I think he's like 17, and he's going, yeah, I could beat her and stuff like that. Boxing wins every time. And I said, you know, when I was young and in my boxing prime, I believed the same thing until UFC came out. And what UFC proved, because, the debate was not – see, BJJ wasn't even around when I was growing up. It was judo, karate, boxing, and kung fu was
wrestling.
Just its foot in the door. Well, so the real debate was who would win.
I think.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, who would win in a fight between a boxer and a wrestler? Well, I'm sitting there going, boxer's going to beat the crap out of that wrestler. And my brother was he wrestled for OSU. And he's like, up until the wrestler gets his hands on you, and once he gets it, boxers have no grappling skills. And what UFC showed, well, mostly the Gracies. The Gracies were dominating. And that is because, yeah, once they got in and got their hands on the boxer, that fight was over. Because
you
just get around and get the rear naked choke. And so, in theory, it's like, well, and you know, I had to think about it for a while. And I go on, now, my style of fighting was I had the reach, and so I was lanky, so I always had the reach. Except one time, one fight, I fought a guy who had a reach on me, and I still knocked him out. But so I just keep that last distance with my opponents. But I was playing around with my brother, and he grabbed me one time. He managed to get in and get hold of me. The thing is, how often, think about this, how often in a boxing match do boxers clinch? A lot.
Well, quite often.
A lot. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, if you go back and you study bare-knuckle boxing, they didn't just clinch and hold each other. They literally threw each other to the ground. That was in the rules. It was when they came up with the Marcus of Queensberry rules that they took throws out of it, okay? And boxers always clinching. And so grappling used to be a part of boxing, and it still get in there. So really it comes down to who's the best fighter, okay? But see, right now there are very few Aikidoists who have been able to convince the skeptics that it will work. And that's mainly because of how Aikido's it's practiced. They just do drills. There's no sparring. There's no pressure test in the traditional school. You don't, you know, it's a martial art where you're not trained to fight. That's the weird thing
It's not who throws the punch, but who can take the punch that's usually the victor?
If I get in a discussion about this with an Aikidoist who goes, well, you could do this and this and this, and my response is, have you ever been hit? Have you ever had anyone really try to beat you up? And I said, the first question you have to learn is how are you going to respond to a punch?
That's right.
If you flinch, you're going to lose. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if I got someone I'm coaching and they're flinching, everything you teach them is a waste until they get past that. And there's ways to teach fighters.
I got sucker punched twice in my life so far. Mm-hmm. Not again. And I realized, even though I didn't like it, that it didn't have a glass jaw and that I could take it. I wasn't bleeding. You know, there are some guys that are bleeders, you know, and I'm talking about schoolyard
At my nose, blood comes out. I'd have to actually, when you get in the ring, tell the ref, I'm a bleeder, so don't stop the fight if my nose starts bleeding. Right, but you have to do that. You have to tell them. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because, like with Amanda, and why she's a natural to it, because I can pop her in the face and she just looks at me, and it's funny because my reaction to getting hit is different from others because I've had to learn to relax. Because my biggest problem was when I got hit, I got angry. If I get hit hard, I got angry, and I wanted to hurt the person that hit me. And the problem
and
is
you lose
I
your
fight.
Control, right? Don't you lose
that's
your
right.
control?
That's right. And it's like the more I wanted to hit my opponent, the easier they hit me.
Right.
Because I'm opening myself up. I'm coming into it. So I have to literally learn to relax when I get hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sparring with this Muay Thai. One of my students at CNU practiced Muay Thai, but he had no sparring partner. I said, I'll spar with you. What did you observe about me? And one, he said, how relaxed I was. And then he said, he goes, and when I hit you, you smile.
I could tell.
So everybody reacts differently.
When I first met you.
Yeah.
You were kind of gliding across the floor, and I asked you the question, are you a martial artist? And so the whole mechanics, I think, Rich, what some people don't understand, and I'm no expert, but that it's more mechanics than strength. And I think Akil probably has that. But I know what I learned. And sometimes I'm messing around with my grandson. He's a big boy. He'll be 13. But he thinks that he can overpower me. And I laugh at him because he doesn't understand mechanics yet.
Yeah.
And he thinks it's so. And I always would clench my fist. And when he was younger, can you open it? You know, start with the pinky. Can you open it? But he's not learned yet. It's not brute force. It's mechanics. That's the beautiful
thing. Yeah. Actually,
art,
I'll tell you
right?
a funny
it's
story.
The art. Yeah.
Yeah. So my son was I've trained for years and competed in Taekwondo, never tested for black belt. I've been training for 25 years in Aikido, never tested for rank, okay? I don't believe in it. A belt doesn't say who you are, and that's mainly because of my boxing background. There's no belts in boxing. Except the championship.
Right. Well,
my son was in Taekwondo and he got his second degree and he was good. He was good because I was coaching him. You know, there's a lot of these what we call belt factories. You pay your money in two years. You sign a contract in 2 years. You get your black belt, whether you're any good or not. But, you know, I made sure he knew how to punch properly. So when he got his black belt, he deserved it. And I also told him, I said, there comes this certain point in time where you gotta diversify. You just can't focus on one. You gotta learn kicks, you gotta learn punches, and you gotta learn grappling. And I said, so you need
and
to
blocking.
Go into another martial art. So after his second degree black belt, we looked around, we found an MMA school, and he gravitated towards submission wrestling, and he was really, really good at it. But anyway, you know how cocky teenagers can get? And one day, he came in, and I was working at my desk, and he looked at me and said, Dad, how would you feel if I beat you up? I thought about it for a moment, and I said, proud. I said, for one, I spent my whole life training in martial arts. Today, you're playing catch-up. The day you can beat me is going to be a long ways away. But when that day comes, that will be a proud day for me because there's nothing I can teach you.
You know, my son was a great wrestler, and I taught him to box when he was a kid. But I'll tell you, when he became really strong and an excellent wrestler, you know, he won 167 and 120 by pin, only lost 39. He's one of the top 100 wrestlers in Virginia. The strength that he had, number one, but I remember you taught him something, and when he won, his coach couldn't believe, where'd you learn that? That's why I believe, and I told my son this, when you get him on the ground, we're all the same. We're at the same level, irrespective of, you know, height, size, or whatever. And you talk about the grappling and all that good stuff. I grappled with a guy from a special operator at Fort Bragg. And, again, it was an honor. Rich, this guy was so strong. You know, what a regimen he had. And I choked him out by the grace of God. You know, we had the fake knife because I'd done Filipino fighting with the sticks. I choked him out. I threw the knife away. At the end of the fight, I still have the picture. We're both fully sweating. I look like I'm half dead, and I won by the grace of God. But again, you know, it's technique. Again, you know, it's just a wonderful thing. But there are certain skills, like your conditioning, that are going to win out in the end. Because if you're not conditioned,
in the stand-up fighting, usually kicking and punching, it comes down to speed and timing. Grappling, anything with grappling is really about feel. And it's not just feel, but see, like in wrestling or BJJ, submission wrestling, all this, there's so many moves. It's like the more moves you know, the greater advantage you have over your opponent, but you got to be able to feel where that opportunity is. And that's different. And Aikido is about that. But we have a smaller skill set. For one, we have no groundwork. There is something close. But if you go to the ground and you get get them to their knees and they have a chance, an Aikidoist, but you get them on their back or something, and that fight is pretty much over. They don't know how to grapple, how to escape.
Right.
Yeah, but so most of their work is in Aikido is standing up throws, standing up kicks, okay? So anyway,
but again, the conditioning.
The
conditioning, when I got my black belt and, you know, I had put all the work in and they got me a beautiful belt before I went in the Army with my name in Korean and all that, you know, in an honorary sense, but I earned it. And I had to fight 12 different people at different times. They call you out.
Right.
I was in the best shape of my life getting ready to go to Fort Bragg at 43. I got hurt that night. I got kicked in some places that weren't protected as they should have been. And in my thighs, because I was, you know, a good runner. But I'll tell you, I can remember when I was first involved, I didn't have the endurance. And this time I did, and each one of them, these are all the black belts, they called me out, and I had to, you know, spar with them. And so I really think conditioning, and I watched that with UFC, I think that's a big part of it too, Rich. What's your opinion?
Oh, it is, yeah. Being in with Aikido, it's relaxing. The more relaxed you are, the longer you can last, because you're not burning oxygen at that rate. Yeah. So every martial art's a little bit different, but yeah, when I'm looking at like in the boxing or the taekwondo, it's, you know, the anything that's punching and kicking, it's going to come down to speed and timing. It's going to be the best fighter. Yeah.
And blocking, I had my ribs cracked. I had a fight that was stopped 3 times, and the Sabin, he's now an 8th degree. You've met him. He said, well, I guess there's a lesson to be learned. And this guy kicked me so hard, cracked my ribs. I couldn't sleep on my back, but
actually,
11 hours, 10 days.
I think I had the same experience a couple months ago when I was sparring with some Muay Thai.
Right.
Went to a Muay Thai school. I was training with him. Now, yeah, I got kicked in the ribs, but it didn't hurt until I got home. And that's when it was like for 2 months I couldn't sleep on that side. I'm going, you know what?
That's right.
I think I got a rib cracked. Right.
And there's nothing you can do. Just get it taped.
I know.
I didn't even like to take Motrin, you know. And it kept spazzing on me. It kept spazzing.
Yeah.
I had gone to Harvard at the time. I had somebody drive me from my church or affiliate with my church to school because I really was – out of commission. So funny, because I was their pastor, they bought me one of those pads, you know, like the Empire or the Umpire.
Yeah.
And I also used a helmet, kind of a very light helmet, because I guess they didn't want their pastor coming to church with a black eye or a busted tooth or whatever. But absolutely. I enjoyed it so much.
Yeah.
I'd like to introduce our topic tonight with a joke when you're ready to transition. I just wanted to ask
you. I've been wanting to shift over to that subject, so take it away.
Okay. So we're talking about personal responsibility versus collective culpability. And I want to tell a story, but I want to tell a little joke. So here's friend number one. And so we're in the gym, and he says to his other friend, "Hey, you have really let yourself go." Friend number two, "No, my wife is simply a great cook." Now, when I was getting ready to get married, spiritually, emotionally, but physically, I went to a Weight Watcher meeting. And this is 1976, maybe 1975, because I got married in June 1976. And this lady was crying because her husband had been home on vacation, but they stayed home, and he took some pies out of the freezer. They defrosted. He ate them, and she ate them along with him. And so when the lady's going through these testimonies, mind you, this is my first time, all right? I'm a 21-year-old, 22-year-old young man. And so the lady says to her, "Did he shove it down your throat?" And I said, "Wow, this is pretty heavy duty here, like these light sessions where people just, you know, speak into your life with candor and hurtful." And so I said, "You know, just give me the diet. I'll work it on my own, because I don't want to, you know, be involved with this humility." But, you know, we don't say, "My bad." You know, when you're in junior high school and high school and you're playing football, you know, you don't really take responsibility if you made an error. Oh, the coach will tell you. But in college, you know the other guys are going to get on your back. So you lift your hand up. "I screwed up. I was the one." So I want to talk a little bit about accountability, and then I'll just share a little bit from an outline, and then we can converse. But accountability, or the habit of a responsible person, and I think we have to ask the question, who are you accountable to and for? Now, confession in my realm is accountability, but it's not for the evader of personal responsibility, however. Because there are times you cannot pin a person down. Now, you said something in our conversation today that it was really good, and that is, you are not a victim, but a victor. The buck stops here with you. In other words, for everyone. The use of the word man in Scripture, in other words, Paul said, "Act like men," has nothing to do with gender, but instead with taking responsibility and being tenacious and having things like perseverance and fortitude. General, and you will know who it is, in the Civil War once said, quote, "I will never put a man in command of troops who cannot command himself." When I was at Harvard doing my postgraduate degree in war ethics, my professor wrote a book called Rights and Responsibilities, and I critiqued it, and he said that I really understood it. His name is Arthur Dyke, Harvard Divinity School. People all over the world want rights, especially Americans, but they want rights, but not the responsibilities that go along with them. You know, everybody wants the right to vote, but they don't want the right to be a responsible citizen. Everybody wants the right to drink, but they don't want to see the importance of being temperate in the way you drink. And I saw something on Facebook the other day, who hasn't had a DUI? Well, I have not. Now, there were times when I was young and foolish that I could have gotten in trouble, but I just think that we don't own up to our own responsibility. So I want to say this. Be responsible for yourself. Take care of your own backyard before worrying about the landscape of the world. Take care of your own backyard. I'm speaking metaphorically, allegorically, before worrying about the landscape of the world. So what happens with personal responsibility versus collective culpability? This is my last statement. It's this. Everybody's is nobody's business, and nobody's business is everybody's business. In other words, no one is accountable to anyone. I just want to tell one short story. It's a little kind of stupid story, but you'll get the point. This man falls into a well. And so this is a group of people that are all accountable to each other on a peer level. So he calls up to his accountability partner asking for guidance. Well, he has to ask his accountability partner for guidance because, remember, there's no structure or no hierarchy. Well, by the time they're finished with this problem, the person who's in charge is the person in the well. And so when we don't know where we're accountable, whether it's my department head, my bishop, whatever it might be, then there's really no accountability. And when you're not accountable and have to give an account, we have to go to confession once a month, then you don't give an account and you make excuses for why you do things. Now, when someone knows your soul, they know if you're BSing, they know if you're being too hard on yourself because they've spent a lot of time with you. So I really want to talk about this in light of some of what I shared and certainly some of your comments on what I share so I can perhaps elaborate and explain them more clearly.
Well, I guess my first question is, why does it even matter? Okay, it's not my fault. I think lawyers have done the most damage to our culture because it's created a culture of victims. Because anything goes wrong, I'll give you an example. All right, I was when I was in California. You want to talk about lawsuit crazy state? That was it. And this woman realtor or whatever it was, she had a cast on her ankle, and she was trying to sue this guy because you know they were walking from one neighborhood to a yard or whatever to another, and he showed her a shortcut that went through a ditch. Okay, and they stepped over the ditch, all right? Well, she came back on her own and took that same path, slipped and fell, and I think broke her ankle. She wanted to sue the guy that showed her that path. So who was responsible for that? I'm like, you can't walk, okay? It's your fault you fell down. Not the fact that somebody showed you this path, okay? But that
I had an incident the other night. I slid into third, into a big puddle of water. And I thought there should be some better lighting where I was. But, you know, it had occurred to me before I stepped there that I probably should have taken a longer route. And it's so easy for us to pass the buck. You're absolutely right.
Right, right. Okay, well, so here's the problem. Or the question is, why does it matter? Okay? See, if that woman, if she could get a slick lawyer and she could sue that guy, she benefits from having fallen and broken her ankle.
Right.
If she can't, she's still not responsible for this. So what does it matter?
It does matter, Rich, both
why?
In our conscience and because it's unjust to responsibility of being self-aware. You know that from martial arts. That was one of the first things I learned. And when people come around me, they wonder why, because I learned, understand your surroundings, be self-aware. So we're not responsible. If I, you know, show you how to ride a bike and you know, I did it with my children with the training wheels, then took it off. If they don't follow through with the instructions, I'll tell you a funny story. My one daughter, when she was four, my oldest daughter, used to come into our bedroom all the time. We'd try to break her of it. I remember I had an exam the next day in Italian. And she misjudged the room, and she fell down the stairs. And she looked at me after I put the light on. I jumped out of bed. She said, "You pushed me." So she didn't want to take responsibility for the fact that she misjudged where the door should have been because she was half asleep. She was only probably four. But I think we do that all the time with people. You pushed me when, no, it was your poor judgment.
Yeah. Well, the way I'm going to explain it is, if we don't accept responsibility for our own actions, we're not going to learn from it. Because
Amen.
What that woman should have been doing is, why did I fall and break my ankle? I mean, am I getting older? Do I need to step further? Or like in my case, you know, I've taken so many falls from martial arts that I always, you know, you see these people with swollen ankles from being out running and they step in a jug, in a pothole or something, and they twist their ankle. I've been running and tripped in puddles a lot, and I get dirty because I fall down and take a roll. As soon as I feel my ankle give, my whole body gives. And that's just the way I've been trained. But see, the martial arts teaches you, since we started on this subject, teaches you not to be a victim. Teaches you to defend yourself, okay? And if you lose a fight, it's you look at it objectively, go, what did I do wrong? You can't blame. Now, there are cases where you get a bad rep and he calls mm-hmm. to fight against you or something like that. You know, that stuff happens. But, you know, the way I look at it is, because I had a fight where the other team was cheating, and I just punished the fighter so bad. But anyway, the point is, you don't learn anything. You don't learn anything, and you're not going to get any better if it's everybody else's fault of why you are, where you are, or why things are happening to you, okay?
You know, I was in basic training at age 41 when I became a chaplain, an officer. We had PT 0420s, and so we were doing a ruck march, and I didn't see a pothole. And I fell in it, I hurt my ankle, and I kept on marching. And so when the NCO filled out the papers, he said, soldier hard, this and that. Now, I reflect on that now. I was careless. I wasn't paying attention. You know, we used to do ruck marches for like 5 miles
right.
with protective masks on, you know, and then you have different fire, and you've done that and more. But I realized that I had another responsibility to myself, since I have to live in this body the rest of my life, not to keep marching on an injured foot. And so, again, it's so easy, and I like the fact that you brought up litigation and people wanting to sue. What that does is deflects, it diverts from me saying I was careless, I wasn't alert, I wasn't watching, and I'm responsible. If we don't learn to do that in life, we will not succeed. If we don't learn to take responsibility and learn, like you said, from our mistakes, we're going to go through life pointing the finger at everybody else, and I wasn't successful because of you. No, you weren't successful because you weren't honest with yourself. You lied to yourself and made excuses about everything.
Yeah, you know, something that struck me when I was young and I was reading the biographies of a lot of very successful entrepreneurs. P.T. Barnum was one of them. These guys were failures.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not just like one time. They failed at one business after the other. Ulysses S. Grant, biggest. Look, I always, when I give the staff ride, I always point out, like, this is the biggest loser there is out there. This guy's a failure. You know what his one saving grace is? He won't admit it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He'll just keep coming. You know, it takes him 3 tries to get to Vicksburg. But guess what? He gets to Vicksburg and he wins. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is taking responsibility. All right, that is taking responsibility for yourself and as we say, soldiering on.
We said today in our discussion, if you recall, when the bombing in Beirut took place, President Reagan came on, and I'll never forget the press conference, and said, "I take full responsibility for what happened."
Right.
Even if there were other men or women on the ground. And I think that if you haven't learned habitually to do that, you're always looking for a way out. And we're doing this article on BS from a Princeton University professor, probably emeritus. And he talked about the manipulative misrepresentation, trying to get out of something. So there's not even a regard for truth, a high or low regard for truth, because you're trying to accomplish something, but you're not owning up. There's not that self-actualization. You're not being self-aware of really you're the problem. You ever hear the joke, Rich, about the guy was at a bar and he fell asleep and they put some Limburger cheese in his mustache? And he woke up and he's smelling around. He's smelling under his arms. He's smelling around in the bar. He goes outside, looks up in the sky, says, "The whole world smells." And sometimes we look at everything else than what's really the problem. And that's hard sometimes. That's why if you have somebody that loves you, and our spouses are never shy about telling us, whether it's our breath or whatever, but to help us to own up to our responsibility. You know, you've heard of people that have been in accidents and then they fled the scene. That all comes to, I don't want to take responsibility for what I've done. And I know that there are people who ruin their lives because they won't own up or they won't face the thing. And I'm not suggesting that it's easy, but if you do it incrementally, if you do it little by little, you've learned, yes, let's take, for instance, I love track. I did long distance, but let's say we're doing a 100-yard dash and someone steps too soon. Well, he or she is the reason why they have to start the race over again. Don't say it was the guy, the gun jammed or whatever. And I just think that it's okay, like you said, to make a mistake and to learn from it, because we learn more from our failures. Now, you have people, they scratch the car or hit something or whatever it might be. And just to say, you've heard the joke too, a person will write a note and say, "Everyone thinks I'm writing a note to tell you that I hit your car and giving you my information, but I'm not." And so he puts the note on the thing. And so you begin to form a habit of not telling the truth. You know, we call it the sin of omission. You leave something out because you haven't learned to be forthright about your own life and having a real sense of, you know, I don't let anybody define me, Rich. I've had good OERs. There might be things people don't want to say about you. I don't let those things define me, but I have to at least listen to your input.
Correct. Actually, if you're not skiing two levels above your ability and falling down, you're not getting better. Okay. Mm-hmm. And when I was a company commander, I kind of borrowed this idea. It wasn't of mine. I'd seen another company commander who used the same philosophy. And so when I sat down with my lieutenants, I explained to them, I said, you learn by making mistakes, okay? And I told them this, you know, skiing two levels built. They said, if you're not making mistakes, you are not trying hard enough. Okay.
You're not doing anything.
So So get out there and make mistakes. But don't make those mistakes we can't recover from. No bodily injury, no loss of life, no damage to property, okay? And don't make the same mistake twice, because that tells me you're not learning. And sure enough, one of my lieutenants, you know, it was a real big screw-up. It was a real big screw-up. The NCOs dropped the – I mean, literally, the NCOs dropped the ball. okay?
Right.
And a lot of it had to do with how he came in and how he treated the SEOs. And they could have covered for him. They could have picked up the balls, but they let the balls fall. Okay. And the battalion commander came down, and he's like, this was such a big screw-up. It got the battalion commander's attention coming in, and keep in mind, as soon as I got there, me and another company commander, we were fixing it, okay? But we didn't get up there.
Mm-hmm.
We're sitting there going like, okay, got it. We can do this, this, this. The other company commander says, well, I can help out on this. I'm like, good, done. So the battalion commander shows up after we've gotten it fixed, and he goes, all right, battalion commander's looking for responsibility. Who, what happened? Whose fault is this? And I explained to him, I said, sir, my instructions to my lieutenant, it's horror. Get out there and make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a really big mistake, but he made it, okay? And they'll learn from it. He looked
right
at me and he goes, you mean this was a planned fuck up? And I thought about it. I said, well, I never worded it that way, but I looked at him and says, well, I guess it is. And he goes,
mm-hmm,
okay, if you planned it, that's okay. And he walked away. But the thing was, we accepted responsibility for this. Yeah, we think,
that's right.
Okay, he screwed up. That lieutenant turned out to be one of my best lieutenants. And the battalion, before I was given up command, the battalion commander come down. He goes, I want him. He says, I either want him as my scout platoon leader or I want him in my S3 shop. But I want him, okay?
Right.
And that, by accepting one, not being, okay, that's the other thing is fear of reprisals, fear of
mm-hmm
the consequences. That's something
that's
else
right
I told my lieutenant. Like, we lost a piece of equipment in Honduras. And that's, Congress was worried that we were secretly leaving equipment down there so it would fall in the hands. We were secretly supplying the Contras, okay? So we had the accountability sensitive items was a very hot issue. And we got off a bus, and one of my soldiers left the night vision goggles on their sensitive item, and the bus drove off. And as soon as the lieutenant had figured this out, he got hold of me. And I congratulated him on that because he knew it's bad news. This is really bad. I got to go to battalion on this. And I told him, I said, I want to congratulate you for getting it because here's the lesson. Bad news does not get better with it's worse. Okay, so
right.
So when you make that mistake or a mistake is made, own up and let's start working to fix it. Because I immediately went to battalion and I said, we know where those night vision goggles are. They're on this bus. Okay. So, and it turned out the bus, had pulled into a motor pool, was locked up, and says, we'll get them in the morning. Problem solved. All because, everybody accepted responsibility. And when you do that, you can start focusing on the solution.
And I think we would both say we're around the same age, Rich, that you learn in a more lasting fashion from failures than you do from successes. Because lessons, I'll not do that again. Whether it's leaving yourself open when you're fighting and you're not guarding your face. I remember when I was at this Dojang, and they had a grandmaster from Korea, and my Sabanim was like maybe 6th degree, and we broke out in little groups. And this one person kept telling me, do this, do this, do this. I wind up punching them in the mouth because they were telling me do this because they outranked me. They were telling do this, but they weren't protecting themselves. Now, was that my fault or was that their fault? And, I just think that it's easy for us to point at other people and what they should be doing and neglect to look at ourselves. The Apostle Paul talks about this. He's talking about, he goes, you're talking about stealing. Do you steal? In other words, in order for there to be integrity, okay, we have to make sure that what we're requiring of others, that we're doing ourselves. And I think what you're saying about taking responsibility, being accountable for, you know, when it comes to, you know, vehicles, and unfortunately we had to leave all that equipment in Afghanistan, but you know how responsible you are if there's an accident, something that we had a difficult situation happen on the DMZ in Korea. And my poor assistant, he couldn't see well, and his glasses were never clean. But, you know, you're responsible. I remember commanders, two outstanding commanders, after their tour, they owed the Army over $10,000 apiece because they did not do that once a quarter accountability for their equipment. Now, this was Signal Corps. There was a lot of stuff. We had over 300 vehicles, it was at Fort Bragg, in our motor pool. And so, you know, you're responsible. So now you have to pay the Army back $10,000 because you weren't responsible during the 2 years of your command. And I remember when I went to Korea, and another friend of mine was a commander, and I watched him do it. Every quarter, he's a West Point guy, by the way. Every quarter. And when it was all over, he didn't owe the Army anything because he was responsible and accountable. And it's the commander who
gets
taught, it's not the other people.
Yeah, you're describing me. I did not owe the Army one hit when I gave up my command. And that was, you talked about the 10% inventories. You know, I think it's every month you're supposed to do a 10% inventory of your equipment. And a lot of people get lazy about it. A lot of commanders get lazy. I'm like, I'm not paying for one thing. I'm going to make sure I have it. And if I don't have personal responsibility for it, you know, it's subhand received to somebody. And we were missing one chair as furniture. One of my sergeants had to pay for it. But, Let's shift the subject. Okay, so we're talking about responsibility for our own actions and our own mistakes. What about when the deck is stacked against you, when environmental factors, or could be society, culture, whatever, is working against. Okay, so you're born I was raised in a very small town in Oklahoma. Oklahoma's ranked, I don't know what it was back then, but Oklahoma's ranked like 49 in the nation as far as quality of education, okay? Mm. So I can't.
And I was raised in the projects in Newark, New Jersey, and the education wasn't great there either.
right. Okay, so we're speaking from experience, all right? What school did you go to?
Dayton Street School in Newark, New Jersey.
No, I'm talking college.
I'm a graduate of Yale and Harvard, yes,
and
by God's grace.
And I did most of my PhD, ABD,
yep.
Cambridge.
PhD,
a West Point graduate, my master's from University of San Diego, a Jesuit school. The thing is, our environment does not define who we are.
No, our tenacity.
The lack of quality education from my school did not prevent me from achieving what I wanted to achieve. It just made it. Actually, my biggest problem wasn't the school. It's that my stepfather had I don't think he made it past, I don't know if it was third grade or whatever, but he definitely didn't finish high school. My mother didn't finish the ninth. She was pulled out of school at the ninth grade. My parents didn't even, the ones that raised me did not finish high school. And they're like, well, you got to get good grades. But I had no mentors. I had no one to teach me how to study. Teach that. When my kids were growing up, we knew how to do this. My wife and I both were college grads, and we knew. And that was the other thing. See, you know, you talk about white privilege. I had no white privilege growing up. All right, I grew up poor. Dirt poor.
Yeah, my
kids, the privilege they had was that they had two parents.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they had two parents who had gone to college, and we provided them the motivation to go to school. They could see that, you know, if you want to have a standard living like this, you're going to have to go to college, right?
Right.
And both my kids have graduated, and my son is getting his first. He just finished OTU. He's getting his getting his first job, and my daughter's been working for a while. Okay, so does our environment define who we are?
I think our character does, because Rich, both of us, we've known each other for a long time. Even with this PhD, you know, my wife made a comment, you know, you wouldn't give up. And, you know, 13 years of college is a long time to attain the goal. But I had a fifth grade reading level, Rich, in high school. I was last in the class behind me because I was a teenage alcoholic. I was in a gang. And the Lord Jesus Christ did a lot for me off the coast of Vietnam when I was 17, just about 18. But I, you know, I'm going to be moving these 5,000 books. I have spent my life loving learning and doing what I had to do. My father dropped out of high school. My mother didn't even go to eighth grade. And I think she tried to go back to high school in her 60s, you know, like night school. But I don't think she
right.
was successful, but she did it. And so, like, I didn't have those examples around me other than maybe the priest or whatever that were educated or people of letters. But no, I think what you're saying is that we, you know, irrespective of, you know, where we found ourselves, and I'd like to write a book, you know, from the projects of Harvard or from the projects of Newark, you know, to the halls of Harvard. But that was all the grace of God, but that was all tenacity, hard work. Let me tell you something. You don't know this probably. It took me 17 years to finish my bachelor's degree. I had to work. I was pastoring. I did all kinds of other training, professional training. I had a family, but I did it. I knew a guy who had only 6 credits to finish. I had 57 credits at the time. I finished my 120 hours. I finished my 72 hours at Yale, my 48 hours at Harvard, and, of course, another 60 for the PhD. This man never persevered. He could have had a job with management, but he wound up working as a factory person. So, and he was from a pretty good family, but it takes tenacity. It takes discipline. It takes goal keeping, you know, and having goals. But it's endurance. It's like life is not a sprint. It's a marathon. And so
right.
I tell my students all the time, I don't tell everybody that, but I kept going. And I did get some after Vietnam, and then my father was 100% disabled vet, but I just kept going to school. Now, I have a lot of other certificates or other training that wasn't, you know, actual college, but I always kept learning. And I just think that when we don't do that, we're wasting the good brain that God has given us. And so it had nothing to do with my, I was the first one in my family to graduate college, certainly the first one in my family to have a PhD. But, you know, it's been a long haul. I just think that we got to take responsibility. Why am I not where I want to be? It's because you haven't worked hard enough at it. You haven't prayed hard enough. You haven't gotten consultants and other people. You mentioned mentoring. You can get there. And you were a great mentor for me as I was doing my dissertation. And I'm very grateful to God, to you, Rich, because you did. You hung in there with me for years. And,
hey,
you know,
I was learning from that experience. I enjoyed it. Yeah. We were both benefiting
from that.
When it's
published and it went through peer review, you know you will get a copy because you deserve it.
Yeah, that's going to be tough reading, though. that is definitely a scholarly. That's one of those. That's a book that's written for other professors. Okay.
You said, who reads the footnotes? Who reads the endnotes?
Bibliography. Yeah, who reads the bibliography?
Right.
Other historians do.
Right. I do it all the time.
Well,
back to the
subject. See, just because the circumstances of your birth and upbringing are very, very low, that is not going to keep you from reaching the highest level. It just means you're going to have to work a lot harder. And you can sit there, and there are obstacles. But obstacles are there to make us stronger. That's the one thing we learn about boxing. And I've seen that. I'm going to admit, my dad, he was doing very well for himself. He was working for Boeing, big the airplanes. He had worked as well. The American dream post World War II was get a job with the big company so you can retire in 30, 35 years. You were working for the gold watch. You may not like your job, but you were loyal to it, and they were loyal to you. Okay, that's what the gold watch was. It was it's that company's recognition for the amount of time you spent, working for us, okay? And then it was to have a family, four kids, a car, and your own home, okay? And my dad achieved that, and then he lost it all. And he had choices, and the choice he took was the one that put him back to where he started. And he just really never recovered that well from it, okay? And, the thing about boxing, what boxing teaches you about life is you're going to get hit. You're going to get hurt. You're going to get knocked down a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But the fight's not over as long as you keep getting up, okay?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly what we're talking about, right? It's easy to quit. When I think about the years of school and the goals that I believe God put in my heart, and being a long-distance runner, especially in the Army, I learned that. My best race was the 10K. In Korea, there were some pig farms, Rich. You would croak. Smelling those pig farms while you were running. You held your breath sometimes, but you ran. And if people don't realize, paved, like you said, with obstacles. But, if you don't get up early in the morning, you don't set goals, you don't put one foot in front of the other, you don't take responsibility for your deficiencies and get the help that you need, you don't trust God, go to other people, humble yourself. When I had to come to you when I was writing and I hadn't heard much of my dissertation share and I just felt like the Lord put on my heart, keep writing. But I had to come to you and humble myself. I need help. I need somebody to read. I didn't ask you to do anything. I didn't ask you to edit anything. But you need to tell me what I need to do better. And you really made that commitment. But there's always someone. I'm mentoring a man right now, African-American man, 35 years old. He was one of my students at Hampton University. He's now up at Harvard. He's a professional person. And I'm thrilled to have that opportunity so he can reach the apex of his goal. But you've got to take responsibility. Yeah, there are setbacks. Look, everybody, Irish, Italian, I get it. We all have had obstacles, not to the degree, good American, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that you have to want it. We saw people in the military achieve great things because the opportunity was there, but you have to pass the PT test. You have to, be proficient and have competence in your profession. And there's a number of things. You have to be ethical. and, you know, have a spiritual component, not be one-dimensional. And so it's very important, but if you want an excuse, it's easy. But if you don't want to fulfill your purpose in life with the gifts that God has given you, then you can let Big Brother take care of you. You can make excuses why you can't work. And look, Helen Keller, when I taught English as a second language to one doctoral student and MBAs, they could not speak English, so they couldn't get jobs well. I had them read with me the autobiography of Helen Keller, and she was a proponent for those who were blind and who wanted to work jobs. And she herself did not learn to speak until she was 10, and at age 24, she was at Radcliffe, which is at that time was the female part of Harvard University. So those things are inspiring. You know, life is not a dress rehearsal. We have one time around, and it's just like it's on you. Paul said it this way: I want to lay hold of that for which I've been laid hold of for. God, why did you call me? What's the purpose in my life? I want to embrace that, and it's going to take a lot of discipline. It's funny because you're using the metaphor of boxing. So did Paul. He said, I'm not shadow boxing, and he used running also and the Olympics and things of that nature. So I think that there's a lot of similarities in our analogies, but it takes a lot of hard work. You know, one of the chapters in my book is called Swimming in Peanut Butter, and I talk about constant effort. And if you don't think that's correct, and that's why people who are more disciplined have an appeal to that work, you know, from valor to virtue to moral development,
right,
to the brave, because it takes time. But I think, Rich, we're saying, look, your name's on it. It's like when you're the football player and you're the one who fumbled the ball, you're responsible. Oh, no, well, you know, there was Vaseline on it, and, you know, it's the quarterback's fault or whatever. You know, it might be mutually both of your faults, but how do you now learn from it, as you said, and don't do it again? When you keep
doing the
same thing over again, you're not, we say in Italian, gabados, you're hard-headed. You're not learning from this lesson.
You mentioned writing, all right? And
writing
humble
responsibilities?
Yourself. Well, no, we're going to use the term humbling. You had to humble yourself. Right.
That's
we were
right.
friends. I mean, that you know, when you sat there and you're going to ask me to come and help you wasn't a humiliating experience. What you knew would be the humiliating experience is what I was going to tell you when I read your book.
Right.
Because we take this pride when we create these words. But here's what I tell people. If you're going to write for publication, you're going to put something out there for the world. This is like this video we're working on for YouTube. Once you put it out there for the public to look, you better be thick-skinned, okay? If
That's
you're going
right.
to publish a book, you'd better be thick-skinned because you're going to get some very bad reviews. And what's funny is, because my first book, the most popular book I've written, is The Filthy 13. And it's got some scathing reviews. I mean, they're some of my favorite. One guy goes, even though you were warned, it was a war story. Another guy, worst book, I actually several of them said, worst book I've ever read, you know, and things like that. But the worst reviews are the best written. But what's funny is that the very thing they don't like about the book is what everybody else likes about the book. Okay,
right.
It's just a matter of opinion. But you have to be thick-skinned. And here's the point that I had to learn, and this is what I had to pass on to you. This is why you know, when you ask someone, or you're going to write for publication, you're going to ask someone to read your book and comment on it. Don't pull any punches. do not spare my feelings, because if you do, and it's not that good, and I put it out there, people are going to be brutal. You're setting me up. So I am sparing you of this. But there's
you always gave me assignments, though, Rich. You always gave me something to do, something to improve, some other.
Well, yeah, and I would see that.
Approach.
I would see it. I would see something in there. I said, okay, here's a pattern. Okay, you need to go back and look at it this way. Okay, well, it's like our video. All right, so the sparring is between me and Amanda. And there in the first video, I also have a few scenes with Daniel. And I had asked him, I said, look, do you guys want to contribute to this, produce a video showing how Aikido is going to work? And with Amanda, she's all for it. I said, but I want to warn you. The criticism is going to be against you, not me, if you are not a credible boxer, okay?
Right.
And we were very comfortable with what we had. And so it was, you know, and then when the criticism did come out, like, well, she can't punch and stuff like that. And I said, but she's fast. There was a couple times they're going like, well, she can't punch. She's no power. And I'm like, but she's fast. Okay. And I was joking with her about it. That usually when I say she's fast, they don't counter that. And she laughed. She said, because she's been reading it too. She said, usually after you say she's fast, that ends the discussion really, really fast. But
Rich,
but the point being is,
blows that connect, and if you're fast and you're throwing more blows, doesn't that count in boxing? I'm saying.
Now, all right. Well, first of all,
we're
not trying to beat each other up. This is in the category of light sparring. In other words, she's throwing punches, but not trying to hurt me. See, when you're having now the video we're producing right now, I'm going to introduce and I say, this is friendly sparring between an instructor and his student.
Right.
I'm not trying to beat her. I'm resisting enough to challenge her to see how many techniques she can get. So he's sitting there going, oh, you know, like I tagged her here, you could have knocked her out. And I said, probably, but that's not the objective. The objective is to see, I'm coming at her like a boxer. How many times can she throw me? Which proves that it does work. Doesn't prove who's going to win the fight. That's not the question. Who's the best.
Have you ever watched film, Rich, your boxing or a football game or wrestling match, sometimes people aren't even cognizant of what they're doing. And when you finally show them in the film, you're doing something you're not even conscious of, and you got to own up to that. Whether, you know,
that's
you
a good
stepped
point.
Over the line. Yeah. You stepped over the line, so you were offside. No, I didn't do it. Yeah, well, okay. We'll do the film in slow motion. See? You were the one that pulled out.
Yeah.
And that's what God
Well, in
do.
Our
I'm
case.
I'm not trying to be funny. God was going to show us. Oh, no, Lord, I didn't do that.
Yeah. But in our case, we're filming our sparring so that we can learn from it. So we go back and we look at, like, for example, there's a Steven Seagal throw. He's very famous for this, where you throw a punch and he sidesteps rapidly, which we'd call slipping the jab. And he comes across their chin and he knocks him down. Well, Amanda was doing that, and the first 2 days of sparring, and I'm looking at it, and I said, and then I noticed he's got everything except the stepping forward part. And I told her, I said, you're not stepping forward. So we rehearsed it. We practiced it. So the last day of sparring that we did where we're filming, she's stepping through and she's just knocking me down. But again, that comes from, you know, by studying what we're doing wrong, figure out how to fix it. And so, like, with Daniel, because he's got a test for black belt, I'm like, see, I can sit there and tell him, you're doing this wrong, you're doing this, this is good, but you got to work on this. He can't see it. so you have to film it so then you can look at it, and that's when you get, it's okay, it's like me coming in and reading what you've written, or someone reading what I've written and getting critical, and I said, hope you don't take offense. I said, no, I'm thick-skinned. I will take what. Now, you may see things different than I do, but the point is, I want you to lay it on me. And the film doesn't lie. That's the whole point about it. So
that's right.
Daniel,
when we
watch
were in
it,
the
study
Army,
it. Yeah.
When we were in the Army, or I was in the Army still, you were a civilian historian, I remember you letting me read some of your work on the Rough Riders. And I was honored by the fact that you asked me, but you weren't looking for compliments, although I was intrigued.
Right.
I felt like I was there. But it is a risk, isn't it, to take responsibility and ask someone to critique you. In a number
but
of
you're not
areas,
going to get better. You're not going
that,
to get better. The product is not
right.
going to be better if you can't take that criticism.
Yes, yes. No, it,
but
I
it all stems. It all stems from a desire to produce the best product you can produce. It comes from the desire to be the best that you can be. As an athlete, you have athletes are I think anybody who's really, really good, they are their own worst critics.
Well, you know, the graders at Fort Bragg, it didn't happen to me, thank God. But I remember hearing them go when the people were doing push-ups, one, 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 one. Until you do it right, you're not getting two. You know, that's a really important thing. You learn what it's supposed to look like. For us, they wanted our chest to bounce off the ground. And I just think that it's important. And so you can't say it was the grader. No, your form is not good. No, and I can remember being yelled at too. You make sure, you know, that the form is good, not just so you can go real fast with your arms. Now, I got to it in my late 40s too. I'd have muscle failure, but I could do about 70 push-ups in a minute and a half. And, you know, but if the form isn't right, and you just can't go blaming everybody that, you know, it's the grader. No, it's not the grader. You're not doing it right. There's a standard. And again, people are always looking for a way out, always looking for an excuse. You know, whether it's, you know, running the 2 mile or whatever it is, and, you know, oh, I didn't stretch or whatever. You know, you should have learned that a long time ago about stretching. You know, and I just think that we finally got to get real with ourselves and put our big boy pants on and be adults about the things. You know, Rich, I can even talk about in marriage. There's certain things, you know, during and I married 45 years, there's certain things that you have to own up. You know, there's certain habits or certain things, and there might be, you know, I remember earlier in our marriage, she'd say, if you're really sorry, why do you do it again? You know, the sooner or later you have to realize it's not the world against you. You just have to be self-deprecating enough to embrace the fact whether your uniform isn't done right. I always had the sergeant major look at my medals. And one time I had a guy, SF, and he wanted me to kind of pull in my, not my blouse, but my class A's at the time. He wanted me to get them tapered, you know. And it's like we need the criticism of others so that we can look sharp. When I went to West Point for my active duty interview, he didn't want me to wear my uniform, any of the medals, and because he wanted to see who I was as a person. And when I left him, he said, I hope sometimes we work together. He thought I was a lot younger than I was, and it was a very good thing. But he was looking for more. You know, we talk about substance and not just the external, you know, that lacks the substance, you know, kind of the image type of thing. But you've got to take responsibility. The scale doesn't lie. I saw a funny joke the other day. It says, boy, that armor of God is really heavy. You know, I got it on the scale this morning. And that's another wake-up call, right? We get on, my wife and I, we not together, we get on the scale every day, you know, because you're responsible for what you ate that day or the day before, especially now with my...
Actually, in my case, no, I'm very conscious of my weight because I joke about it. If you go online and you start, if you type in Aikido and you look at all these Aikido instructors, they're round. Aikido, when you get really, really good, it's effortless. And because it's effortless, you don't get an exercise. And there was, I mean, when I started out, it was a lot of work because I was muscling it. The better I got, the less muscle I used. And all of a sudden, what muscles I... Now, I had my boxing workout, but I realized I need to change my workout. I've got to start lifting weights again to give myself that anaerobic exercise. And then, I have to run. I have to run. And you know, I'm like 66, and I'm out here running 2-3 times a day. And people ask me why. I said, well, I'm a martial arts instructor, and I need to look like that. I need to look like a martial arts instructor. You know, you see somebody overweight, you know, teaching martial arts, you know, you're going to question, what's the product? You know, am I training to look like you? And first of all, are you really able to do what you say this martial art can do? So we have to, so in my case, I have to set a personal example I will tell you, all right, when I grew up, I thought people died after they're 45. You didn't see any. Well, I grew up in a place where all you do is hunt and fish, okay? life was hunting and fishing. But anyway, but they didn't work out. You did not exercise, you know, after 45 or even if you exercised 45 until I got to the academy. My Taekwondo instructors were in their 50s, and I think my first one was 60, and our second one was Sang Soo Tiger Kim, and the guy, he was in his 50s. He was also, I believe, he was a weightlifter because he was built that way, and he would always take his shirt off and get pictures. He was just buff, and I looked at that guy, and I remember I'm going. And he's in his 50s. I've never seen anybody athletic in their 50s. That became a lifelong goal for me. And I said, when I turn 50, I want to still be working out. I want to still be training in the martial arts. And I remember how proud I was when I turned 50 and, you know, I was still training in the martial arts. I was in Aikido by then. Mm-hmm. And here it is, I'm 66, and I'm like, there are Aikidoists out there who are in their 80s. That's my goal. I plan, you know, and I'm sitting there going, like, I am not as excited as about training beginners. Okay, I'm kind of like the old boxing coaches that just kind of like want to train champions. And I've got my senior students. So basically, where I am, I'm you know, that's why I am so eager to get this. While I don't care about rank, I do want to get Daniel, you know, his black belt, so he can pretty much take over and start training everybody, training the new people, so I can have my one-on-one. I love practice, and I can sit there and do the one-on-one classes with the senior students. I love the coaching. That's where we're heading.
And I enjoy that more than teaching the undergraduates, because I want to produce leaders, especially, you know, it's in the seminary and in the CEC. But no, I hear you. But again, let's take, for instance, homework assignments. That really bothers me. I took a course this summer, a reading seminar from Harvard Divinity, a lot of reading. What disturbs me sometimes, especially if you give a lot of time to a student, I know they have other classes, but they won't take responsibility. They try to BS through the discussion, or they might say, you know, they didn't have proper time management, so they didn't read. That bothers me. I even had some at a very good school, and they were seniors, and they weren't prepared. I was surprised. But you have to take responsibility, because I do say, when I ask students who did not read it, and they're honest enough to lift their hand, even though it's embarrassing, I'll put my money on that person faster than the person who's going to try to BS them their way through it. I don't know if you ever saw this funny commercial. This guy and girl, I guess they're going out, and they're in a book club of sorts. And he didn't read the book, and he listens to some kind of, you know, spark notes or something on the radio or on some podcast. And so they get into the meeting, and they're talking about it, and he regurgitates what he heard on this podcast. And so they get outside, and she looks at him. She goes, "You didn't read it, did you?" And, you know, being honest, taking responsibility for whatever reason, you know, I didn't have time to do it. I'm wrong. I'll make it up. I'll do something extra. But don't try to snow your way through and lie to everybody plus yourself. That's not taking responsibility. And then when it comes to the grade, you know, we saw a lot of that during COVID. People were milking it. Every little thing. I mean, I'm three times their age. I got the shots. I had it function. And I just think that we need to allow young people to feel more. You know, I was in the military at 17 years old, making $245 a month, 1971. I was considered, and I had very good fitness reports, but I was judged as a man, not a boy, not a teenager. No one ever questioned my age either, but I just think that taking responsibility instead of making excuses. But I was raised in a home where we had to work, not only in the home but outside the home, to help support the family. So I'm real concerned about this personal responsibility and our collective culpability, because we've let everybody get away with not taking responsibility. And so as a nation, or maybe some of the Afghani people or other responsibilities that we have, we've made excuses so long. Now we're even excusing ourselves collectively as a nation, and we are culpable.
Yeah, all right.
Especially
Let's talk about that, because we kind of discussed that a little bit.
Yes, sir.
There has been a significant change in our culture about this personal responsibility. What has it been? You mentioned about the duality of Clinton, okay?
Yes, the duplicity. Yes,
duplicity,
you're one person,
yes.
But you have a personal life and a public life. It makes you duplicitous because you're not integrated. You should be a whole. That's having integrity. And although, Rich, you might act a little different with your family, but you're essentially you, okay? You're talking about history or martial arts, no matter who you're with, or whatever, and a different thing that you used to do for the Army. But, no, I think that's very important. But we have excused one another. And let me just say this word about adolescence. There's no such thing in the Bible. So we say, you know, I always tease the students, you think this is the best years of your life because you could be irresponsible? You're kidding yourself. That's it? 4 years of college doing your own thing? But we've allowed this adolescence. And so you're not a kid and you're not an adult. You don't see that in the Bible. I had to get working papers. We had to work because we were poor. So you were treated like an adult at a younger age. Today, no one wants to become an adult. And I think
you
that
know, when our grandparents grew up, they were pretty much working beside to adults at 13.
Yes.
At 13,
yes.
you were pretty much considered an adult. You could leave home and go off and get on a cattle drive or whatever. Okay. And then the law, I will tell you that laws have come in to really keep people from growing up. All right. But
yeah.
I'm going to tell you a change in the Army that I saw as a result of the Clinton era. And that is about honesty. Mm. You know, as an officer, you got caught lying, cheating. Theft. Okay, we're stealing stuff all the time for the betterment of the organization. To lie, that is a career ender right there. And when I don't know if it was while you were there, you are still our chaplain, but all of a sudden we just started getting an increase in plagiarism. And it
was
in the paper I had to write.
Yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But we were having plagiarism, you know, and here was the thing, it was becoming so common that before it was automatically you were booted out of the Transportation
right.
Officer Basic Course, and then all of a sudden it was getting to be such a problem, we were now like, they're punishing them. They're on probation.
Right.
And now at West Point, where it was, when I went through, you know, as soon as they read you the rules of the honor code,
mm-hmm.
any violation after that, you were booted out, okay? Now you have to learn. This is where we are in society today. You have to learn honor so that your first 2 years, if you get caught lying, you go on probation or whatever, but you don't 2 years, right? We now have to teach people honor. What changed in our – I mean, you go back to the 19th century, and people write about it. Their honor was their word.
That's
if they
right.
said they would do, you know, they gave their word of honor, that was binding. That's not a
That's
case
right.
anymore. So
yep.
something in our culture has changed. And I'm like, to me, the pivotal thing was you know, the President of the United States lying directly into the television.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you right now, if you look at Biden, you know, the honeymoon with the mainstream media is over. And Biden will get up there if you listen to his speeches, and then you switch to CNN or ABC or whatever, you will listen to the media just point out everything he said is wrong. And I'm sitting here listening to this guy, and I'm like, he spent 40 years because he has lied so much he doesn't know what the truth is. To him, there's no moral compass when it comes to being honest.
I tell you,
he doesn't see
James
the problem
said,
with it. That's what I think is really going yep. on here.
Mm-hmm. James said something very interesting last week, and I think people have gloated and have politicized and weaponized what happened in Afghanistan. You know, I got my working papers at 14. Like I said, I went into the military at 17. And your example with our grandparents is an excellent one. They're just not taking responsibility for their own lives. So therefore, you no longer have that sense of dignity and pride as to what your purpose is. You know, working through college, having to pay. We even borrowed off of our house, and there were other funds and different things. You know, God made provision. But if you don't sacrifice, you don't appreciate what you have. And I think in many ways, that's a reason come irresponsible, right? That's the opposite of being responsible. They're irresponsible because we do it for them instead of making them do it themselves. I read a wonderful book. This man teaches at Harvard Business School. He said when he was a kid, they had a large family. He said like third grade or something. He had a hole in his sock or a hole in his jeans. And his mother gave him a needle and thread and said, sew it. And he reflects on his life. How will you measure your life? His last name is Christensen. What a wonderful book. I've used it at a number of venues, of colleges, business school, ethics courses, and I just don't think that we're handing over the ball. It makes me think of when you're overprotective, let's say you're a quarterback, and you pass the ball to the halfback, and then you hold the ball with the halfback and run into the end zone together. Look, you've got to let people experience life so then you can't blame it on the quarterback. I had the ball. I didn't hold it like a breadbasket or whatever I didn't do. And I, you know, allowed it to slip out of my hands. Otherwise, people will never take personal responsibility, and we will have a mass of culprits in the sense that we're all excusing one another, you know, because we're blame shifting. And I just think that we have to stop doing that, and it has to start with me, and it has to start with you.
Okay. So let me throw another one in there. Mm-hmm. Your house gets burnt down by one of the California fires. Your house is swept away by the hurricane in Louisiana. Or is destroyed by rising flood or flash floods in New Jersey or Pennsylvania. Okay, is that your fault?
Of course, it's
these
not
are what
your
we would
fault,
call
but,
acts of God. What personal
you
responsibility
didn't buy
got to do with this?
But if you didn't buy insurance, and though it's not your fault, but it's not the way you react; it's the way you act. You still have a responsibility.
Okay, that's what I'm
going to
get at.
Find,
so the personal responsibility is not about assessing blame, but it's about what?
Right. It's about taking
it's about what you do after.
Find, that's right. For your family, finding another home or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
you got to now rebuild.
Analyze it.
Yeah.
But you have to. You can analyze it. You can move to another part of the country where you don't think that'll happen. But the point is, you can't say, okay, government, I can't make it anymore. You got to take over. You got to take care of me. And no, we have, look, I believe in compassion. There are things, especially for our veterans, that the government needs to help with, not only, you know, veterans organizations. However, you have to respond. You got to keep going. But if you never learned to pick yourself up, you kept saying that with a boxing illustration, which I thought was excellent. If you don't learn to keep getting up, I one time I had to help a guy, and he was a graduate of a military academy. I won't say which one. I tried to help him up. There was a number of guys that a plan that they were involved in failed, and, you know, he was contemplating doing stuff to himself and stuff. But every time, Rich, I tried to bring him up, he tried to bring me down. So finally I left him there. Because he didn't want to get up. And so I think, you know, it depends on resilience. It depends. You know, our daughter passed away 5 years ago. Do you just sit there and say, I'm not going to live my life anymore? Everybody goes through crises, tragedies, and war, and all kinds of situations. But how do we build resilience? You build resilience just like when you're lifting weights and you're going against the pressure. That's how you get stronger. Well, you build resilience by getting up again, like you said earlier. And that's where you get strength in your legs. And so you become responsible when you own up and you'll say, oh, I'm going to take my ball. I'm going to go home. No, you failed. That's okay. I mean, I've gotten Fs. I've failed courses. I've done different things. And you don't just give up. This isn't for me. You said it earlier. You know, we think of Abraham Lincoln. You think of a lot of people who had so many failures. We talk about Babe Ruth's 1,300 strikeouts. But it's the tenacity, the stick-to-itiveness. Now, I learned that from my mother. I had no problems in basic training because her training was even more difficult. Now, it wasn't as rigorous as some, but I'm talking about psychologically. She was tough, but she made us take responsibility and do things. And I think that's where we're having a problem, where we're letting these young people be children until they're, you know, older. You know, what they could be on your parents' insurance till you're 26 now.
Yeah.
You know, I was married 4 years.
Yeah.
So
you nailed it right there. So, you know, there are circumstances that are beyond your personal control
that
are going to knock you down, but it's your responsibility to get up. It's your responsibility to rebuild. Yes, we have programs that are set aside to help you. We talk about the vets, and that's something James is really big on. Yes, it's programs taking care of the vets. But these are to help you. You still have to take responsibility for yourself. You have
to
fix the problem. Yeah, but you know, we have to help veterans. You know, there is, again, that personal responsibility. Like an athlete, as you're trying to overcome these difficulties, all right?
Or an injury even.
Yeah.
Right?
So you just got to keep pushing, persevering.
You know, I had an injury in the Army, and
I had a lot of them.
But I'm talking about this one particular. I could run 11 miles. I mean, I could run. Rich, after this accident, it was during physical training, I couldn't walk 50 steps. And I realized as I was rehabilitating, I didn't get physical therapy. I, you know, had to sit in a chair, this kind of thing, nothing. I realized I was babying myself, that I was so afraid, and I was, you know, taking Motrin and this and that. But I needed to get back where I was. But it was my responsibility, my willpower. It's not somebody else to get in there and make me train hard. I have to want it. I have to want to get it back. And I couldn't even walk down the street. I mean, it was a shock to me because I, you know, but it was such a bad, it was a back injury. It was such a bad injury. And so I just think that, you know, we can help you. We can support you. We can inspire you. We can, you know, cheer you on. But you have to start the program. And you got to bite the bullet sometimes. You know, I was in a fraternity, and we used to get beat. And, you know, years and years ago, 1967, December 3rd, I remember, was hell night. So we used to put our ties in our mouth, Rich, when I took straps because I had a hernia. I looked like Popeye when they were done with me. But then we paddled them. And, you know, if you could break the paddle, you were, you know, who a guy. And you just bit down, put that tie in your mouth, and you sucked it up. And because you wanted to be a part of this fraternity or this gang.
Whoa. That sounds like abuse. That's physical abuse right now. That's been outlawed. Okay.
I said
that is very, very bad. What the hell good did you achieve from that? Okay, talking about someone who went to Airborne Ranger Special Forces course and went through Beast Barracks at West Point. What? Okay, that now we as a culture look down on that kind of abuse. What possible good could be achieved by that?
Mother wouldn't let me stay home. She said, they beat you up, you stay with them. That was the only night she wouldn't let me stay home. They gave me an Epsom salt bath. Yeah, you know, you're trying to be a part of something. You're trying to be tough. You know, we had to keep books. You had to keep orders. It was this big deal, you know. And obviously, you know, it's illegal and it is abusive. But the point is, life is hard. And if you haven't faced any hardship, you're not going to make it. If you live in
there
a Pollyanna
land. Okay, you nailed it. You nailed it. Absolutely. That's what all. Now, all right. Why this kind of hazing has been outlawed is because there are bullies who have abused that. And there are people who have been killed by it. Okay?
Yes, that's right.
There are people who have died
right.
because of hazing. all right?
Right?
Yeah, there are bullies who get in there and abuse this system.
Now, I'm not condoning it. I'm just telling you my experience.
No. I believe in the heart basic training. I believe in,
you can't take a beating. This is the thing, though. You know from basic, if you can't take a beating, you're going to be in a bubble in life and think that you're never going to fall, your kid's never going to scratch his or her knee. And I'm not saying that was right, okay? But life, you know, Rich, life will throw you around. Life is tough. So you take responsibility.
Okay. Yeah, and you know, if there's a course set up that is controlled,
possible.
Controlled beatings, controlled punishment, it makes you a stronger person. My son, all right, he did the Taekwondo and then the submission wrestling. Then he found BMX, you know, the bicycle acrobatics and whatever.
Cool.
He got into that. And, I mean, he was breaking bones. He was busting himself up. But the worst part of it was he was breaking the bicycle. And he came in to, you know, my wife comes to me and goes to buy a new bicycle frame because he busted his bicycle frame with the jump. It came down so hard it fractured it. And I think it was like a regular bicycle frame is $150, but there was one that was much more durable than like $300. My wife there, who's, you know, as you know, she's pretty stringent when it comes to spending money. There's like, I don't know if I want to spend this much money on a bicycle frame that he's just going to break again.
Right.
And I said, do you know how much physical energy it takes to break that bicycle frame?
Mm.
I'm willing to spend $150 for him to go out there and bust that bicycle frame. Otherwise, he's going to be sitting on the couch playing video games. And when I put it that way, she goes, yeah, you're right. Here, let's buy that bicycle frame. Okay? But it was, and he was doing, you know, but athletes take personal responsibility. They go in and they subject themselves to this brutality because they know they're going to get better, and they're look, you're not drafted into a fraternity. You join a fraternity because you want to embrace that. You're not volunteered into Airborne School. You're not volunteered into Ranger School. You're not volunteered into Special Forces. You ask for that kind of abuse.
Right. That's
because
right.
You want, you know, if it was easy, it would be worth earning. Not everybody can do this. The washout rate is high. Okay?
Right.
That's what makes it elite. Hey, we got 3 minutes, man. Let's wrap this show up, okay? What's the lesson here?
I want to go back to my professor's book, Rights and Responsibilities, because like I said, everybody's talking about the rights that they want, but they don't know that associated with those rights are responsibilities, irrespective if it's a license, if it's drinking, if it's military, whatever it might be, going to college. And we have to recognize that with every right, okay? When my daughter became 18, I said to her, guess what? You could go to jail. It's great. You're 18 now. You got this right. You know, you're an adult. But you also can be punished like an adult. And so I want to emphasize that. The particular book is Rights and Responsibilities by Arthur Dyke, was a professor of mine at Harvard Divinity School. And I critiqued it, and he thought that I really understood it. And I just think that we have to talk about responsibility alongside rights, but not only talk about our rights, but what responsibilities come with those rights.
All right. Okay. That's a good summary. Now, we got less than a minute. Both Father Michael Pacella and I, Richard Kilblain, are published authors. You can find copies of our books, which are dramatically different, on Amazon. Just go in there and look up Pacella, P-A-C-E-L-L-A. I don't think there's a lot of Pacellas out there, authors. Kilblain is a rare name, K-I-L-L-B-L-A-N-E. You type in Kilblain on Amazon, you're going to pull up my books, okay? So I want to thank everybody for listening to us tonight, and I hope you learned something from this, and we'll be looking forward to talking to you again next week. So good night.
God bless. Bye now.